So, given time, I'm going to try to keep this session as much as possible within the time frame that is given for each of the presentations and so on. Thank you for coming back after the tea and coffee break and being reinvigorated with the caffeine and tea that has been provided. We have here in the panel a small panel, but a panel of very distinguished speakers. The first is going to be Sri R. N. Ravi, former special director of the IB here in India. And the second will be Tondup Gyalpo, who is a senior fellow at the Tibet Policy Institute, and whom I've known for a number of years, and I look forward to hearing his presentation as well. The first presentation will be on the Panchsheel Agreement of 1954, about which we just heard a little bit already in the last panel from Sikong, Dr. Lobsang Sangye. And without further ado, I'd like to invite Sri Ravi to please start the session.
Thank you, Chairman, and distinguished persons present here and friends. At the outset, I'd like to thank TPI and the India International Center for organizing this meet on Shimla Convention 1914. I thank them because others are not talking about it. China is not talking about it. It is understandable. It's inconvenient for them. But what is intriguing is even India is not talking about it as it should do. Shimla Convention, it was an attempt to codify the contemporary geopolitical realities of Tibet. It defined Tibet-China relations, Tibet-China boundaries. It acknowledged limits to China's intervention in Tibet. And it was also an attempt to secure peace and order to the northern frontiers of India. Now, this convention being so crucial for India, so much at stake, and still we don't talk about it, is something that we Indians need to think over. Instead, we are celebrating Panchsheel, because Panchsheel was an attempt to undo to a great deal what Shimla Convention 1914 did. And that's the reason perhaps why China is very keen in celebrating it. They are doing it with fervor, with gusto. Recently, our vice president had been there. And India has joined the chorus in year-round celebration in the shape of friendly exchanges, exchange of cultural troops, dignitaries, exchanges among the men of science and literature. So this celebration is a celebration of Panchsheel between India and China is going to be an year-round event, whereas we are not talking about Shimla Convention. After all, as I said, China has reasons to celebrate because with this Panchsheel Agreement, India legitimized military occupation of Tibet by China. It also accepted the militarily altered geopolitical scenario on India's northern frontiers, because instead of Tibet, it's China which became our neighbor. Until then, China was neighbor only in the remote western part bordering Afghanistan, but to the Xinjiang province of China, not the rest. But by signing this agreement, we accepted the altered geopolitical reality or calculus. It is good for China. And using Panchsheel and quoting Panchsheel, China continued or even continues today intruding into the privileged sphere of India's neighborhood. It gets into all the countries that are proximate to India, and it engages with those countries in a way that undermines India's security. After all, 70% of arms that China exports, and China is the fifth largest arms exporter in the world today, the 70% of it comes to India's neighborhood. And they say, well, it's all the principle of equality and respect of mutual sovereignty that we do. We engage with these countries, and they stimulate, China stimulates fear of India being an hegemon and offering itself as a counterbalance. Now, so China has multiple reasons to celebrate Panchsheel. I wonder, what are the reasons for India to celebrate it? Is it the loss of Tibet that we are celebrating? Is it the fact that we accepted China as our neighbor? Or is it the continued hostile border that we keep facing the problem of anon, intermittent transgressions, military face-offs? It keeps happening. And these are logical culmination, as I understand, of Panchsheel Agreement. You know, Indians have been misled through generations. When I was a child, at the time when Panchsheel Agreement was signed, and in our primary schools, our teachers used to sing songs in praise of Panchsheel. It was touted as a gift given to us by our great leader, something imbued with mystical or magical qualities, a talisman that would bring peace in the world and ward off any evil that looks towards India. That is how it was touted, and we all, without knowing what exactly Panchsheel was. But then the rude shock came a few years later in 1962. If you look at Panchsheel as an agreement, its architecture is weird. It has a preamble, like any treaty, any agreement, that is supposed to sum up the essence of the agreement. And then the operative part, substantive part, where you have clauses obligating the contracting parties. If you look at the substantive part of it, it's a continuation of trade and travel, nothing new. This trade and travel has been going on between India and Tibet since long, long before, even before 1914. Indians have been going to Tibet, scholars, pilgrims, traders, and Tibetans have been coming to India. So much so that we have a lot of Tibet in India, Tibet in Indian psyche. So this a kind of exchange that was taking place, it was reformalized or renewed, put it like this, in 1954. But with a difference, and the difference was that this time, though we signed treaty for travel and trade between India and Tibet, Tibet was not a party to it. It was done between India and China. I mean, it looks on the face of it absurd because it is a departure from its historical context, because even in terms of agreement, it has been renewed repeatedly after every 10 years since 1914 with Tibet, and suddenly Tibet was out. Now, this otherwise mundane kind of an agreement, except for the fact, which is very seminal and very important, is that China took over the role of signing the agreement. The preamble is a formulation of very lofty principles. I mean, on the face of it, the two look incongruous. There is a disjoint between the two. The preamble sets out the principles, perhaps the larger universal principles, how the nations should engage with each other, respecting each other's territorial integrity and sovereignty, non-aggression, non-interference in the internal affairs, working for mutual benefit, and peaceful coexistence. Now, how this preamble fits into this trade and travel pact, which has been a continuing affair, except for the fact that this time there's a Chinese who signed it. Who was seeking assurance or reassurance from whom? Was India afraid that perhaps China, having taken over Tibet, it might try to extend its tentacles and it wanted to contain? Or was it China which was insecure in Tibet and it wanted India to restrain itself? Now, that's open to debate. But the fact is that the whole agreement looks like a cake with an icing. It was a cake made by the Chinese according to their appetite, according to their taste, and perhaps they allowed our great leader to do the icing on it by coming up with universal principles of how the nations should engage with each other. So they take away the cake, they swallowed it, and we kept touting the preamble. And that's very absurd. You know, I have been, as a student, as a working adult, and later in charge of the Tibet desk in the Home Ministry and Intelligence Bureau for over 20 years, I have been struggling to seek meaning of it. Why did India go for this kind of agreement? I haven't got a sane answer as yet. Perhaps someday some psychoanalyst would do the analysis of the people, those who authored this, and come up with an answer. But as such, I don't think we have a clear answer to that. Panditji had a very quaint notion of geopolitics and geography. When 1949, communists took over China, and they made it intention clear right then that they were going to invade Tibet, what they called liberation. And when the concern was in Tibet, concern was expressed in India, Panditji sought to calm the concern by saying, why are you worried? China is not going to invade Tibet because Tibet was too weak. So it's a very original thinking that if you are weak, you are secure. China would not attack. I don't know whether that went into India's defense policy, that 12 years or 13 years down when they invaded, we were, how ill prepared we were. When 1 year later, when they took over Tibet militarily, and again the concern was raised in India, Panditji again came up with his sense of very unique sense of geography. He says, don't worry, Chinese cannot stay for long in Tibet because its terrain is so expansive and arid, so harsh. They cannot. They will leave quickly. And here perhaps he could have been right, except for the fact that he opened Calcutta port for supply of food to Chinese military in Tibet. Now, somehow, the leadership at the time was such that they had a different understanding different from what others or any student of geopolitics would like to have. Similarly, soon after this Panjshir agreement, when China became aggressive and started intruding and looking towards India belligerently, Indian borders, and again we raised concern, our people raised concern, and a fear that perhaps China might invade India. At the time, Panditji said, no, your fears are unfounded because we have Himalayas in between. And these are all on record. It's not that someone has manufactured, it is there on record. Himalayas as a protector. He further went on to say he was a great visionary. He always thought in larger terms, not in a small terms of India, Tibet, these things. He said, should China invade India, there would be world war. 1962, China invaded and India was alone. No country stood by India at the time. There was no world war. He further said that China would not invade India because that would jeopardize its prospect of getting membership to the UN, for which he had put in all the political and personal resources for getting Chinese membership to UN. All these calculations went awry, didn't work. Now, the result is that today, while Tibet is suffering, its ecology, its culture, are under threat, serious existential threat, we do not have peace at the border. We keep worrying how to counter that Chinese menace. Though we might be talking very nicely at the diplomatic front, at the official front, but yes, there is a serious concern. Last year, 2013 in April, when the news leaked out that Chinese had moved in about 30 kilometers inside in the Daesung plain. Well, while there was uproar all over the country, our then foreign minister again played it down, said it was just an acne or a pimple. Again, one fails to understand why these people try to play it down. Why do you have to come up with such trivial metaphors to explain a serious problem? A friend of mine who is a psychoanalyst, he actually, when I was intrigued at this use of acne and pimples, he said, "Why are you feeling so intrigued?" Because, you know, a person who has a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. If you talk to a soldier, he will frame the issue in a military terms. You have a foreign minister who spends considerable time of every day in front of a mirror, and to such a person, The problem that exists is one that affects the look. And perhaps the most insignificant or minor problem that can affect the look could be a pimple. I got some sense that yes, perhaps that could be true, that this is how they play down the serious development. Now, we know, I mean, what it is, how unfair it has been. The question is, what is the way forward? How do we go from here? That's important. Now, when we talk about way forward, some of my friends say, are you talking about war? Should we have war with China to resolve the issue? No, certainly. Talking of war is insane. We cannot talk of war. China and India, they must be friends. India-China friendship is essential to peace and prosperity in this region and beyond. There's no doubt about it. But at the same time, we should also realize that a durable India-China friendship is not possible without a satisfactory resolution of the Tibet issue. The Tibet issue has to be resolved to the satisfaction of Tibetans, and that would lead to a durable India-China relationship. Now, this fact has to be understood by the government of India. It has to be understood by Indian people. And towards this end, in our own way, we should cajole, pressurize, persuade, whatever we can do, to impress upon China that they must resolve the Tibet issue. And for resolution of the Tibet issue, to the satisfaction of Tibetan, they must resume the dialogue with the Tibet government. And when I say Tibet government, I'm talking about Central Tibetan Administration, which they have discontinued for last some time. It must be resumed. Another issue is, count on which we can do something is try to give some content to the autonomy, the notion of the concept of autonomy. We have accepted that Tibet is an autonomous region of China, but here, autonomy is defined unilaterally by China. Let's not forget, and let's remind China that Tibet is not an entirely internal issue of China. It affects India viscerally, it affects India organically, it affects India in many ways. It's not merely about 150,000 Tibetans, those who are in India, but much more than that. So the autonomy, the nature of autonomy, cannot be unilaterally defined by China alone. There they have to take into confidence the views of the Tibet government and give it a legitimate character so that it becomes truly, and what His Holiness Dalai Lama says, genuine autonomy. You know, other speaker in the morning, they said about our civilizational bonds, cultural bonds, we have very deep and broad. We should do something to strengthen it. There is so much hidden, we need to be dusted off, we need to be taken out. We can undertake several projects jointly to again make our people literate, make our people know that there is so much together that we have had and continues to have. Now, as China is celebrating, or perhaps along with that, the government of India too has joined that a year of Panchsheel celebration, can't we think of celebrating a centenary of Panchsheel agreement? That similar agreement. Let more and more discussion, more and more seminars, more and more talks be held in Indian universities, it be held by Indian think tanks, Indian people. When we talk more and more about Shimla Convention, because Shimla Convention, British India was a party to it and it impacts on us so critically. So this year can be and should be declared as a centenary year for the Simla Convention. It is not just centenary year for, as Kalon Tripa said about this, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, 14th Dalai Lama, but it should be centenary year for Simla Convention. Let's talk more about it. No one says, you know, between war and peace, there is a lot of gray areas. Whenever we talk of being a little frank with China, people, they say this, why do you? Do you want to provoke China? It's not the question of war. You know, the thinking, the binary thinking, which right from Panditji's time we have had. Whenever issues were raised, Panditji used to say, do you want us to go for war with China? No, there is a lot of space in between. If I ask frankly, are we fighting China today? Are we at war with China? Certainly not. But are we at peace with China? Equally not. So between war and peace, there is a lot. There is a broad spectrum which should be explored, which we should try, and we should strengthen the cause of Tibet, because through that, we are strengthening our own cause, bringing on peace and security on our own northern frontiers. Thank you very much. I'm reminded of that.
Thank you very much. I look forward to the discussion.
Issues that I was going to. So in order not to sound repetitive, I would like to cut short on those areas in which they've already spoken about. In my paper, what I've tried to do is basically deal with two main issues. That's the Shimla Convention in the larger Tibetan historical context during the reign of great 13th Dalai Lama, when he tried to reassert and maintain Tibetan independence. And the secondly, what I've tried to deal with is the present validity and relevance of the Shimla Convention in the resolution of Tibet issue. On 13 October 1913, the plenipotentiaries of Great Britain, Tibet, and China assembled in Shimla in order to negotiate on terms of equality a solution to end the state of war that existed between Tibet and China and of defining the political status of Tibet. The Shimla Convention, as such, features prominently in the popular Tibetan histories as one of the major historical facts that proved the de facto independence of Tibet in 1914. Irrespective of the eventual outcome, the Shimla Convention was, at least from the Tibetan side, an effort to seek a de jure recognition of the de facto independence status that Tibet enjoyed at that time. The larger Tibetan historical context behind the Shimla Convention cannot be conveyed without considering the great 13th Dalai Lama's lifelong quest for the independence of Tibet. The Tibetans always claim that historically, Tibet and China existed as separate countries, and there was no political relationship between the two. There was only a priest-patron relationship, which was first established between Mongol rulers and Tibet, and later inherited by the rulers in China. In the priest-patron relationship, the priest provided the spiritual guidance and the patron provided protection of the priest country. This protection did not make the priest a subordinate to the patron, nor the patron the owner of the priest's domain or territories under his rule. The complex nature of the historic status quo between Tibet and China was dramatically altered by three events in the first 11 years of the 20th century. Firstly, the growth of British interests and relations with Tibet, culminating in the successful military invasion of Tibet and Lhasa by British in 1904. Secondly, the consequent efforts of the Chinese to re-establish control over Tibet, culminating in the military operation in 1910 by the Chinese General Zhong Ying. And finally, the Chinese overthrow of the Manchu dynasty in 1911 and the mutiny of Chinese troops in Tibet. The mutiny of Chinese troops provided an ideal opportunity for Tibetans to wage an armed uprising against the Chinese, and by April 1912, all the Chinese troops were forcibly evicted from Tibet. The Dalai Lama, who had escaped to India in 1909, triumphantly returned to Lhasa free of Chinese troops and officials in January 1913. Shortly after his return to Lhasa, the Dalai Lama issued a proclamation to all his officials and subjects that unilaterally reaffirmed his total rule in Tibet. Tibetans considered this proclamation, along with the 13th Dalai Lama's earlier response to China's strongman Yuan Shikai's telegraph, in which he refused the Chinese government's offer of rank as a declaration of independence. About a month before this proclamation, Tibet entered into a treaty of mutual recognition of independence with Mongolia. The treaty was signed in Uga in January 1913 between the new Mongolian government and a representative of the Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama's triumphant return to Lhasa did not, however, end his problem. The fall of Qing dynasty produced no change in Chinese position on Tibet.